Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
In these troubled and troubling times, there is kind of a lift from talking about some relatively benign subject, like pigeons. Maybe you don't even like pigeons, but you'll like them better at the end of the show, and you'll respect their intelligence. B.F. Skinner famously trained them to play games and figure things out. But, I mean, there have been cases where pigeons have been taught how to recognize the difference between a Monet and a Picasso without having seen the work of either artist in advance. So, I mean, I know people who can't do that. All right? So we're going to talk about pigeons and how smart they are, and maybe you'll feel a little bit better about them, even if you don't feel better about much of anything else today.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Good morning, Marvel boy. How you feeling today? Big race today. It's a 350. Very tough field, so I'm here to help you get ready. All right, open your beak, and I'm just going to squirt a little bit of this juice under your tongue. It's juice. You know, all the top pigeons are using it, so open wide, Marvel Boy. I got to make sure it all gets in there. What's in it? Well, you know, a little Clomid, amphetamine, some anabolic steroid. It ain't Hawaiian punch, if that's what you're asking. All right, let's see that little pigeon tongue. You gotta take it. You're racing against Belgian pigeons. Belgian pigeons. They're like the mayor of Toronto with wings. They got so much drugs in their system. Now look, I've put a lot of money into you. You've had the best pigeon food there is. And let's just say that I didn't make you take a vow of celibacy when it comes to the lady pigeons. Now you owe me. Take the juice. Take it. Take it. Take it. You better take it. Damn it. Okay, have it your way. Spend the rest of your life crapping all over park benches and sitting on top of a statue of Alexander Hamilton. And you'll just be nothing. You'll be just another pigeon. And you know what? You could have been somebody. You could have been right up there with the great ones. Tumba, Eurostar, the Duke. Instead, you'll be waddling around Washington Square asking little old ladies to feed you. That's more like it. Now, here's a squirt for you. And one for me. Ugh. Because Mama need a little helper too, right? Okay, let's try a little practice flight. Okay, I might have the dosage off a little bit. Meanwhile, here's everything we can tell you about pigeons in 1 hour. And now, he says they're delicious with just a little bit of truffle oil. Colin McEnroe.
I would like to report with some chagrin and embarrassment that I played the pigeon in that sketch, that I actually went into a studio today and made pigeon noises until Calhoun Wolf was satisfied. And I would also like to say that although we are going to address the whole subject of pigeon doping today, which is an actual real problem in the world of pigeon racing, there are a number of pigeon stereotypes in that sketch that are semi-unfair, and we will address those as well. Joining us right now, well, I'll tell you who's to come, first of all. A little bit later, we'll be talking to Yoni Applebaum, a social and cultural historian and a doctoral candidate at Brandeis University, specializing in the military uses of pigeons, especially an odd sort of triadic configuration during World War I of pigeons, the U.S. military, and the Boston Red Sox. But as either Andrew or I could tell you, I mean, the pigeons have had many military uses over the years and well past World War I into World War II. Also a little bit later, because I've always been fascinated by one of the more quotable Gertrude Stein lines is "Pigeons on the Grass, Alas," which, first of all, may have been sung for the first time right here in Hartford. So Wanda Korn, a Robert and Ruth Halperin Professor Emerita of the Department of Art and Art History at Stanford University, is going to explain to us as best she can, as best anybody can explain Gertrude Stein to anybody, why "Pigeons on the Grass" would inspire "Alas." But we're going to begin with Andrew Bleckman. He's the managing editor of Orion Magazine, but more importantly for our purposes, he's an award-winning journalist and the author of "Pigeons," a 2000 book that I read, "Pigeons, the Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird." So when we decided we were going to do a show about pigeons, Andrew was our go-to guy. Andrew Bleckman, you know, there was some mention made in this introduction of pigeons crapping on park benches and sitting on top of Alexander Hamilton, all of which actually does go on. But one of the canards, to use a duck term, against pigeons that I realized from reading your book is pigeons don't really poop more than other birds, right? It's just, it's more a question of where they poop.
That's exactly right, Colin. Basically, pigeons are urban creatures. They like to be where we are. I mean, there are creatures that like to be around humans. So when they poop, we happen to notice it. They tend to like, you don't see them in trees so much. You see them, I mean, they come from cliffs. So, in fact, they're called rock pigeons or rock doves. And so they like ledges. It's where they naturally feel comfortable, and statues, stone statues. And that's where they poo.
They poo. So, and one of the things, one of the chapters of your book delves in considerable detail to the whole bird control practices, various things that have been used to get rid of pigeons, because there's a lot of times when people don't want pigeons around because they make big messes and because they're, you know, they are associated with certain diseases and there may be certain things in their poop, even though their poop was prized by the Egyptians as a great source of fertilizer. But really, the most sensible thing that I think you found in your book was a scientist who said, really, it's just all about feeding them. If you don't feed them, everything changes.
Yeah, I mean, the trick is this. First of all, don't go out and berate someone for feeding them. There's a few essentially closet obsessive feeders of pigeons who will go out often before even daybreak to put food out, sometimes bags of food, bags and bags of it. Every city has them, you know, slightly mentally ill or at least compulsive. Your average pigeon feeder, though, is, I mean, I would not want to take that away from somebody, which is either a young child or someone who has a day off or is out of work or someone who's retired just sitting on a bench and feeding pigeons. The trick is this, though, is don't overfeed them. And better than to feed them bread, which is the easiest thing, you know, just a little bag, like a little handful of bird seed is the way to go. Because the reason why the poo ends up feeling like concrete and a pain in the neck and like it's going to last and doesn't wash away is because that's just how they digest white bread. Simple carbs. If you give them bird feed, which is basically protein, it just washes away like it would in the wild.
We should probably at least try to define what is a pigeon. People often kind of use the terms pigeon and dove interchangeably. I know pigeons were of great fascination to Darwin. It's actually, I think, the first chapter of Origin of the Species is about what a pigeon is or about pigeons in general. And I know even since your book came out, Andrew, there's been more work done on sequencing the pigeon genome and answering some of the questions that were near certainties at the time of the writing of your book. But so explain, you know, what are we talking about when we say pigeon?
Well, first of all, pigeon and dove are essentially the same thing. Every pigeon is a dove. Not every dove is a pigeon, because a pigeon is a subspecies of dove or a type of dove. Pigeon's just French for dove. I mean, you can blame that on William the Conqueror. English is peppered with French synonyms. So it's essentially the same word, just like Paloma is Spanish for pigeon, which is what Picasso named his daughter.
Yeah, the Picasso will weave in and out of our conversation today in odd ways about pigeons.
Well, that's always nice. I always like to talk about Picasso, if possible. Pigeons go back. I mean, we're about 130,000 years as a species of, you know, Homo sapiens or Homo sapiens sapiens. And they go back about 30 million years as feathered dinosaurs, essentially. They've been with us They were domesticated around the same time as the as dogs were. One of the oldest human friends. They, like I said, they prefer rocky ledges, and they probably hung out in the openings of our caves and maybe our early farm steads in Mesopotamia with the mud walls. Maybe they would perch in there somewhere. And wherever there were humans, there's always pigeons. As we domesticated cereals and grains, they hung out more. Essentially, wherever you find a human, you'll find a pigeon loafing nearby, looking for handouts, but not that different than my dog, Ginger. She likes handouts, too.
Well, your book took you into several different demimonds of pigeon fanciers and people who use pigeons for purposes both sacred and profane. One of the reasons we're here talking today about pigeons was a set of reports about the world of pigeon racing. Now, I had no idea that the world of pigeon racing was so infested with potential criminality, although you do actually point out in your book that certain members of the mafia have been fond of pigeon racing for a long time, and that there's something about pigeon racing that implicitly, I suppose, invites paramutual wagering. But now comes the report that in Belgium, which for some reason or other, which you will no doubt be able to explain, Belgium, which is just a hotbed of pigeons and pigeon racing, there are now reports of pigeon doping, that the pigeons have been given anti-inflammatory drugs. One pigeon tested positive for cocaine. First of all, I don't think anything about pigeons surprises you anymore, Andrew Blackman, but did this surprise you?
No. not really. Well, cocaine sounds stupid because it's only in your system for about 30 minutes, and those races tend to be for, 3 to 6 or 8 hours long. So nothing like getting a quick start and then stalling out. look, wherever you find money, you're going to find corruption. You know, right now I'm in NPR's New York City studios, at the southern tip of Manhattan's Wall Street. Wherever you find money, you're going to find corruption. You're going to, just like you did with the World Series that was thrown with the White Sox, in the old days. So doping of birds, sure. They dope horses, And they dope pigeons. There's a lot of money in it. I mean, at this point, pigeon racing typically, I mean, there's a lot of good people in pigeon racing. Mm-hmm. And it really is one of the oldest sports out there. The Queen of England's family is very fond of it. It's one of the great old hobbies because it's an extremely time-consuming sport. You really have to spend time. I mean, it's animal domestication. It's in husbandry. You're dealing with training your pigeons, raising them, feeding them. And as one of the characters in my book, Orlando says in it, is nothing feels better than walking into your racing club knowing that your bird won because, like, you fed it right, you raised it right, you trained it right, and you did everything right, and it won. It came back, and it was the winner. Unfortunately, it's turned into a sport, like a lot of sports, where, there's now basically pigeon studs. If you want to stud your pigeon with one of these ones in Belgium, usually at these stud farms, you could pay up to $100,000.
Yeah.
So, and it's a different kind of sport. I mean, at this point, they're racing all these birds, usually raised by somebody else. Like in South Africa, they're all raised together. You just send them a squab, a baby, and then they just throw them up in the air at the same time, see which one comes back.
I read about a pigeon named Usain Bolt who was sold for what they believe is about $400,000. How can there be that much money? How does anybody make the money in pigeon racing? Are there gigantic purses in pigeon? I mean, how can they be worth a lot of money?
It's a side bets.
Yeah.
It's a side bets. Yeah. I mean, the purses can be big. And some of these races are now global. Mm. I mean, there's one in South Africa it's a huge purse. And people are shipping their baby pigeons before they're imprinted on even where they're from. Sometimes I guess they'll ship eggs. And they're trained by somebody else. Really, it's just a genetics game at that point. And there's a lot of side betting. But, I mean, the people who are generally doing this racing at this point, like the real traditional racing, are usually immigrants to the U.S. I mean, that's how I got interested in the whole story of pigeons. People are just doing it in the rooftops. If you look up, you'll see people and pigeons.
Well, let's actually meet some of those people right now. Our own Patrick Scahill, a while back, did report on pigeon fanciers, on pigeon racers. So let's play a little three-minute piece we call Patrick's Pigeons.
So what do you need to get into pigeon racing? Well, first, you have to have a lot of pigeons.
in Bill Desmaris' case, 300 in his backyard. Then you tag the birds, load them onto a truck, and ship them hundreds of miles away, where they get released all at once. The bird that flies home fastest wins.
We call it racing, they call it flying home.
In a typical race, birds fly anywhere from 200 to 600 miles. Nobody knows how pigeons navigate. Most scientists think the birds pick up on many cues, landmarks, smells, and magnetic sensitivity. Desmaris thinks it's something internal, like the radar in a submarine.
Beep, beep. There must be something that tells them, beep, beep, through taking around, beep, they go home.
Now, racing pigeons aren't like the pigeons you see in the park. They're stronger, bred for their endurance and brains.
See, I mean, see, look at that right there. One of my best ones right there, see it? See, looking around, very intelligent, seeing what's going on. Strong, big chest, big wings, you know? Yeah. Like thoroughbreds of the sky, like racehorses of the sky, you know? See him crowing and strutting? He's a cock. He's crowing at that hen. He's putting a show on. I'm the boss. I'm the big guy, you know? I'm in charge.
These tough birds are also built for speed. With a favorable wind or hawk on their tail, racing pigeons can fly as fast as 90 miles per hour. Today, Bill is waiting for his birds to return home from Verona, New York. The flock is circling a three-story loft he built behind his house.
Come on!
Pigeon racers come from all walks of life, lawyers, doctors, and ex-Marines like Bill. But they all have one thing in common.
They're all characters. Every one of them is a pigeon flyer is a character. Just by the nature of what he does, flying pigeons. How many people fly pigeons?
Oh, look at this guy.
Harold, how about shot and beer? How about shot and beer? You never drink water, you get sick.
Tony Biaderski is one of those characters. He used to play soccer in Poland, but for 33 years, he's raced pigeons in America. I'm with him at a pigeon club in Wallingford. His house is right next door.
So did you build the coop yourself?
Yep.
Yeah. How long did it take to build?
The coop was building 2-3 months before the house.
What did your wife think of that?
Oh, she don't complain because she know I like it. They know the pigeons is my life.
Tony sometimes bets on races, but other pigeon flyers like Wayne and Tina Spakowski say the sport is about other things, like caring for your birds. Pigeon racing isn't without risk. Hawks, power lines, and surprise weather can all keep the birds from coming home. So the Spakowskis are careful not to get too attached.
Once you name them, it seems something happens to them.
Yeah, we had always had one that would always chase my feet. So we called her Feet for the longest time. And of course, you know, one race and she never came home.
Oh, Feet.
We lost Feet.
Today, the Spakowskis' pigeons are getting loaded onto a truck bound for Toledo.
Come on, you knuckleheads.
Ralph Dupree is their driver. He's driven pigeons for nearly a decade. Dupree will drive all night, releasing dozens of birds the following morning. He says he'll find a nice spot, a place with good visibility and no power lines, and then it's just a matter of getting out of the way.
Sometimes you get crapped out.
And for the Spakowskis, well, the race results weren't great either. But with competition nearly every weekend, they'll have plenty of opportunities. And when winter comes, they'll begin mating their best birds, continuing on the never-ending quest to breed the perfect super pigeon for next season.
All right, that's our own Patrick Scahill. Andrew Bleckman, I think you heard some of the immigrants that you were talking about in that piece, and I'm sure
Absolutely.
In the sensibilities reflected in that piece, a lot of sensibilities that you recognize from the time that you spent among pigeon racers.
Yeah, I mean, they're good folk. I mean, it really is one of the last great hobbies, and it's dying. It's dying with that generation of immigrants, whether they're Polish or Jamaican, Belgian or Dominican or Puerto Rican. Or Peruvian. They're from all over the world or the Middle East. I mean, pigeons are basically beloved everywhere but the United States, from what I could tell. And it's hours and hours and hours and hours a week. And you have a lot of what I call pigeon racing widows or racing widows, you know, the poor suffering wives who get half the attention that the staple pigeons gets. And, you know, these guys call their birds thoroughbreds. And in a lot of ways they are. These birds will fly from a place they've never been before. I mean, they're trucked out. And, you know, so let's say it's 500 miles away, which is pretty typical. They'll fly home at 60 miles an hour, not stopping for food, water, rest, or anything. And they'll home in on their loft, basically like a laser-guided missile at 60 miles an hour from a place they had never been before. I mean, compare that to a racehorse, which really just runs, a few furlongs, which is basically a mile and a quarter maybe, just a few, you know, 1 1/4 times around the track. And so they can't get lost. And even a great, great, great racehorse is really only going about 35 miles an hour and only for about a mile or so.
They are gentle folk, these pigeon fanciers. You can sort of tell that. On the other hand, they have come under attack from people for the ethical treatment of animals. And the argument being that a lot of the pigeons don't make it back. In fact, you know, maybe even half the pigeons don't make it back for one reason or another. Some of them maybe just don't come back. Some of them get hit by hawks or power lines. I think PETA has also claimed that slow pigeons are just offed by some pigeon breeders. What's your answer? If somebody from PETA were here right now, what would you say to them?
I'd say they're partly right. I'd say pigeon racers really enjoy their birds, and they love racing. And the two mix in a certain kind of way. I mean, if you have a slow pigeon or a pigeon that doesn't come back, you really don't want to come back. You don't want the pigeon back. I mean, sometimes you'll see a bird maybe in the city with a little racing band around it. You know, it's like a little thing around its ankle. Mm. The trick is really not to try to research it, but just kind of let it loaf in the city. Because a lot of times they really don't want the bird that can't come home on its own, and you're breeding racers. It's like the boxer that can't get up, chronically, and it gets knocked out in the first round. You really don't want it back. So it's a mix. They love their birds. They love the sport.
Could be like a Jonathan Martin type pigeon too. It just decided it didn't like the competition. Maybe there was another pigeon bullying it or something. Decided to drop out of competition. Speaking of the band, one of the more chilling stories that I read is that once again in Belgium they've had a problem with pigeons being stolen. And what the smugglers do is they don't bother to smuggle the pigeons. They tend to be apparently Chinese organized crime groups, and they just cut the leg off that has the band on it. And then they just take the band home and put it on the leg of an inferior pigeon. And then claim some great pedigree for it, so it's worth a lot more money, which is a
horror. It's amazing thing. What we humans will do.
I know. Pigeons would never do that to humans, I don't think, anyway, although who knows if they were given a chance.
I can guarantee you the greediest you'll get in a pigeon is one that tries to peck one piece of seed too much.
Well, you know, speaking of pecking one piece of seed, and this will be the last thing before we go into our next segment, but it sort of can set up kind of some of the military stuff pretty well. One of the many people who's been – there are two people that we should talk about. One of them is Mike Tyson. I hope we can get to him. But one of the other people very interested in – and by the way, if we don't get to it, you should read Andrew's book, at least for the chapter where he's running around trying to have an audience with Mike Tyson. Spoiler, he doesn't – get to, but the what he goes through in the process is very amusing and lots of fun. But B.F. Skinner was kind of, if not obsessed with pigeons, B.F. Skinner, the great psychologist of the 20th century, was somebody who believed that some of the innate capacities of pigeons made them very worthy of study for the kinds of theories that he was interested in, especially operant conditioning. Actually, let's just play a little clip. I don't know if this is B.F. Skinner's voice or not. I couldn't figure that out. But this is an old black and white clip that shows two pigeons batting a ping pong ball back and forth across a flat surface.
The two pigeons are at either end of a small ping pong table. One pigeon pecks the ball as it comes toward him and knocks it toward the other pigeon. Other pigeon pecks the ball back across the table. If it goes past one pigeon, the other pigeon can eat, and if it goes the other way, the other pigeon eats. So that there is it's a real game. The pigeon is reinforced for a cross-court shot if that is what gets the ball past his opponent.
You know, we'll talk about Project Pigeon in the next segment with Yoni, but Andrew Blechman, one of the things, you watch some of these things from the Skinner Institute, and one of the things you cannot help but conclude is that pigeons are actually pretty smart.
Yeah, pigeons are, they have a lot of innate abilities. I mean, they have, they're able to see infrared, they're able to, they have ultrasonic hearing. They're very good at finding something that doesn't belong as a pattern. Like I remember seeing an old video of pharmaceuticals going down a little ramp on a conveyor belt, and they can pick out the one that has a defect in it, like the one pill or something like that. They're very bright. I mean, I guess humans. I mean, their homing instinct's amazing, and we've been doing that since Egyptians were using them to send them up and down the Nile to send water readings up and down in ancient Egypt. They were used to bring word of the Olympics back home. You had Julius Reuters started his entire news empire, Reuters news gathering agency.
I was amazed by that in your book. That was one of my favorite things in your book, is that the guy who started Reuters, who actually had a different name and changed it to Reuters, started out with pigeons actually traversing a certain area, bringing messages back and forth. One of the many, many amazing little subplots or little items.
It was a little gap in the telegraph system, right. Basically from Berlin to London. There was a little gap around Aachen because there's some very hilly terrain there. And he was able to fill that gap with pigeons delivering news.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back with more about pigeons in the militaries. All right, let's take a little break, and then we'll come back.
If I were a pigeon, I'd clear up a couple of things. I'm a cousin to the sparrow. I'm not a rat with wings. Sure, I may live on pizza that you toss to the curb, but don't go trying to step on me, or I'll give you what you deserve.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speaker series.
Hey, yeah, what do you think of that phone?
She's a beauty.
She's at Hayes. Name is Swifty.
Oh. Oh, look what he went and did. He's my lead bird. He's always on top of the perch. You know, if another bump tries to come along and take his place, he really lets him have it.
Even pigeons aren't peaceful.
Well, one thing about them, though, they're very faithful. They get married just like people.
Better.
And they stay that way till one of them dies.
That's nice.
We're back with our show about pigeons. Our anchor guest today is Andrew Bleckman. He's an award-winning journalist, managing editor of Orion Magazine, and author of Pigeons, the fascinating saga of the world's most revered and reviled bird. Now also joining us is Yoni Appelbaum. Yoni Appelbaum is a social and cultural historian and a doctoral candidate at Brandeis University. He is not getting his doctorate, we want to emphasize, in the history of pigeons or even in historically fascinating details about pigeons. But he has become interested in pigeons, especially around the time of World War I. And as I said before, fascinated especially about a certain triadic configuration between the military, pigeons, and the Boston Red Sox. So he's going to begin by telling us a little bit about that. Andrew and I will be chiming in with even more pigeon military history, a great deal of which there is in his book. But Yoni Appelbaum, welcome to our show, and tell us about pigeons in World War I. This was, once again, you know, we were just talking about Reuters, but pigeons were often used to sort of patch up some communication network, which needed to go at a faster speed, and that's one of the things that they were used for in World War I. Tell us about it.
Well, thanks for having me on. That's exactly right. And I stumbled across this because I'm not only a cultural historian, I'm also a baseball fan. And like I suspect a lot of your listeners, I was tuned in to the World Series. And they mentioned that during Game 6 of the World Series in 1918, there were troops on hand dispatching pigeons at the end of every inning and carrying the score and the details 37 miles away to Camp Devens, where there were some 50,000 troops training to go off to France. And that just seemed fantastically strange. They had telephones, they had telegraphs, they had what they called wireless radio, and it seemed very odd to be strapping the score to pigeon legs and sending it off 37 miles when you could pick up the phone and ask what was going on at Fenway. And what cultural historians tend to do is find odd little threads like that and start tugging to see what comes out. And I tugged and found this fascinating story of what the military was actually up to at Fenway in 1918.
Well, one of the things they were trying to do, I think, is build up pride around this whole idea and maybe also instill a lot of people all at once with the importance of pigeons, because part of the problem in the training period with the pigeons was that because people have sometimes shot at pigeons to amuse themselves or maybe even to eat them. That was happening, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you've got this very odd juxtaposition. You have a small group of pigeon fanciers within the United States who are actively raising them as a hobby, as Andrew's described. And then you have most Americans relating to pigeons as either an item on the menu of a fancy dinner party, as squabs, or as a target for hunting, or perhaps as a nuisance. The groundskeepers at Fenway were known to scatter breadcrumbs and wait for the pigeons to swoop down and then blast away with their shotguns. So there's this dramatic shift in attitudes that takes place at the beginning of the war. General Pershing, the commander, gets over to France and looks around, and one of the first telegrams he sends back is a demand for the army to start finding itself some pigeons. It turns out that pigeons can plug the gap in battlefield communication in a way that nothing else in that war can. There's an expectation of instantaneous communications because we do have technologies by then like telephony and telegraphy, but it's really hard to keep those technologies up and running on a battlefield with fast-moving units, which move faster than you can string wire and to send secure messages back. So the Army starts recruiting these tremendous numbers of pigeoneers and pigeons. They enlist nearly 1,000 pigeon handlers. We send some 15,000 pigeons over to France. We have 10,000 of them stationed domestically. We're training them. We keep on taking them out by airplane, on foot, and releasing them so they can fly back to the posts and learn how to do that. Farmers are taking pot shots at them. The Army resorts to going to the newspapers and announcing that these pigeons are soldiers training to fight for their country. And they go so far as to say that any person who tries to kill any pigeon whatsoever may be stabbing the boys in the trenches in the back. So there's this real rousing appeal to patriotism that centers on the pigeons. It's both practical to keep them alive long enough to learn their duty, but also as a way of making Americans feel tied to the war effort. And that's what they're doing at Fenway Park, ultimately. It is the 1918 equivalent of a flyover. The World Series opened at Fenway with four F-18 Marine fighter jets buzzing low over Fenway. And in 1918, buzzing low over Fenway were pigeons.
And Andrew Blechman, this is a familiar story to you, and the use of pigeons went on into World War II. There were pigeons being used once again pretty much the same way, right? Sometimes to carry even encrypted messages?
Yeah, I mean, pigeons are... I mean, my favorite story is always Sharon Mee from World War I with the Lost Battalion. They were behind enemy lines and our own military was sending shells on and firing on them. And they had a few pigeons with them. And the soldiers, as they were hunkered down, and they sent one up, shot down by the Germans by rifle, sent another one up with a rescue message, shot down. And the third one, Jeremy, was actually shot but kept going and made it back to the American base. And they immediately stopped firing, but the poor Jeremy was basically blown to bits. She still raced back to deliver her message with one leg dangling. She couldn't even really land. They're still being used now. They're being used. Look, if you don't want the NSA eavesdropping on you, well, then put your iPhone down and put down your high technology way of sending messages. And if you're if you're an insurgent in Iraq or Afghanistan, send it by pigeon post.
Still
being used.
Yeah, and actually, and this I think occurred after your book was written, but in England a couple of years ago, they found a pigeon in a chimney, and the pigeon appeared to have died during World War II. On its leg was an encrypted handwritten message from World War II, which the codebreakers today were unable to crack, but they believe that it was actually flying home from British units in France around the time of the D-Day landing in 1944. So
they were dropped from airplanes with parachutes. They were let out of submarines that would quickly surface. Pigeons. In fact, we dropped a ton of pigeons with the French Resistance. All they had to do was with a piece of paper and a pencil, and we'd parachute them in, And then hopefully they wouldn't be eaten by the French resistance. But if they had a message to give back, they would just put it in the capsule, let the pigeon go, it would fly back across the channel.
You know, Yoni, Andrew's book is subtitled The Most Revered and Reviled Bird. And that dichotomy or that odd paradox kind of runs through all pigeon stories. For every story of them doing something really terrific, then there's a story about people really hating them or doing something horrible to them. And ironically, especially ironically, given the players, I'm also a big Red Sox fan too. And so Ted Williams, who was probably the most militarily heroic Red Sox player, actually left baseball twice to fight in two different wars for the United States. On the other hand, never got the memo about how great pigeons are. I'll let you pick up that story.
Yeah, no, it's a great tale because there's Ted Williams, who is flying for his country in World War II and again in Korea, but doesn't have a whole lot of respect for these pigeons who are also flying for the same country. He was one of a number of Red Sox players through the years who used to enjoy taking target practice at the pigeons out in the bleachers. He'd go out there and blaze away at them with his shotgun. On at least one occasion, he was joined by the team's owner, Tom Yawkey, who the street in front of Fenway is named for now. Lefty Grove, who was with the club in the 30s and the early 40s, was also notorious for doing this. It got to the point where one of the feuding sports writers, and Williams had notoriously bad relationships with the media, dropped a dime on him to the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty for Animals, who went after him for doing this, and he made a public apology, but privately remained unrepentant. So you've got, in 1918, pigeons flying over Fenway Park to rally support for the war, as soon as that wartime service is over, Cheremi is stuffed and put on display in the Smithsonian as a tribute, alongside the French medal that he won in the war, and Williams goes back to blazing away at the pigeons of Fenway Park as nuisances, pests worthy of extermination.
Well, Yoni Applebaum from Brandeis University, great to talk to you about all this. Andrew Bleckman, as we sort of wind up this segment here, since we're talking about that and about Ted Williams, I mean, one of the other things that you did, speaking of demimondes into which you descended, you did briefly descend into the world of target shooters who continue to shoot at live pigeons. If you go to a skeet shooting range these days, you wind up shooting at what is sometimes called a clay pigeon. You wind up shooting at sort of an inanimate target flung into the air for you. But there's a small group of skeet shooters who still shoot, or at least at the time of the writing of your book, still shot at thousands of pigeons released over the course of maybe even just a single day of shooting, right?
Yeah, actually, I was the first and probably the only journalist ever, I guess, I don't know, infiltrate such a thing. Animal rights groups and other journalists have tried for a long time. And I infiltrated by agreeing to be part of the shoot. And luckily, I'm a horrible shot. I knew it. You know, I'm not about to hit a skeet, live or otherwise. It's a horrible situation. It's slowly dying off, but it still exists. Basically, you have people who poach pigeons from the streets in New York City, usually early in the morning just as the sun's rising, which is when pigeons wake up. They'll put some feed out, and then they'll just net them, and then they'll throw them in vans. And then they'll race them out to central Pennsylvania or just rural Pennsylvania. And that's where they're most popular, these shoots. And there's a whole schedule of shoots. And they take the pigeons. They're usually starving and dying of thirst. Very, very disoriented. They're literally thrown into catapults, which then catapult them into the air, just stunned. And then they're used basically for as pure on target practice with shotguns. And the goal is to shoot the bird and have it land within a certain circle. So, the closer to the bullseye, almost as if it were darts. And the birds are just left there to die while the shoots go on. And it's just a bloody, bloody situation with dead and dying bloody birds everywhere. Some of them will be able to fly away just a little bit. Then you'll see them upside down in the parking lot. And then they pay young boys to go around and collect them, throw them into trash bags, sometimes twist their neck. Sometimes they're just thrown in there and then just thrown in a trash can.
It's a depressing part of the book. Hey, we've got a call from Kate in New Milford. I know this phrase is mentioned in Andrew Blackman's book. I don't know that he necessarily knows the etymological answer to this, but let's give it a shot. Here's Kate in New Milford.
I was just curious where the phrase stool pigeon came from.
All right. I know that you mentioned the phrase stool pigeon in an early part of your book, Andrew, but I'm not sure that – does anybody know where that comes from?
You know, I can't remember. I had a professor who always told me the best kind of professor was the one who said, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
when there was an answer to a question. I just can't quite remember, except for pigeons were thought to be somewhat stupid over time. And stool pigeon's just someone who's not real bright and will squeal.
Right. A stool pigeon, yeah, somebody who will squeal. It would be entertaining to make up an explanation, which I'm quite capable of doing on the spot, but maybe we'll hold off on that.
Instead, I got time later today.
All right. Instead, yes, my article in Orion Magazine will go up later today explaining the origins of that phrase. All right. So we're going to take a quick break. It's our All Pigeon Show.
I have written down a notice, take it to my darling Anne, show it to her, please. Carry a pigeon along, song is tied to your foot. Carry a pigeon, fly over Connecticut with my love song. This is the start of it, a love song.
Here we go. You just drank an ingestible formula that uses a CRISPR-Cas9 genetic editor to resequence your DNA on a molecular level. Science rocks.
Wow! Okay, here's what I need you to do. Pretend like you're a normal person talking to a much cooler normal person.
In precisely 45 seconds, you will transform into a pigeon.
Oh, okay, might pass out.
Oh, you're definitely gonna pass out. Your genomes are being smashed apart so they can be reassembled with pigeon DNA. Think of each gene as having a switch, and one by one, your switches are flipping to pigeon. Human pigeon. Human pigeon, 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 human pigeon. It worked!
My eyes!
It worked!
What did you do to my eyes?
Hey, Lance, look at me.
Look at you? I can't not look at you, Walter. I can see my butt and your face at the same time.
That is so cool. Fact, pigeons have 360-degree vision. Now nobody can sneak up behind you.
Stop, girl, come
on. This is so great. Pigeons can be found in every major city around the world, and no one notices them. It's the most perfect form a spy could take.
Nope.
All right, we are talking about pigeons. We did have a question about stool pigeon. Actually, Neely Bruce's name is up on the board here as a caller. When I saw that you were calling, I assumed that you were calling in to talk about Virgil Thompson's Four Saints in Three Acts, which we are going to talk about in this segment. But it turns out that's not why you're calling up. You're calling up about the phrase stool pigeon.
Yes, that's exactly right. This is the origin of the term stool pigeon. It has to do with passenger pigeons, and passenger pigeons were hunted in enormous numbers. They were hunted to extinction, but one of the standard techniques was to put a decoy. Passenger pigeons liked to go down on the ground where there were other passenger pigeons, so they would put a decoy down, and it was a pigeon on a sort of stool-like thing that had three legs, but could be completely jerked out of the way so it didn't get damaged. And the pigeons would come down in enormous numbers, and they would be shot on the spot and then sent off to restaurants or wherever to be eaten.
Well,
a stool pigeon is a pigeon on a stool that is used to attract other pigeons to where they will be killed.
So a duplicitous pigeon. Well, it certainly makes sense, and I'm sure it would pass the fact checkers at Orion Magazine. So Neely Bruce, composer, conductor, I thought you wanted to talk about Virgil Thompson. It just goes to show you should never assume anything. We're going to be talking about pigeons in the arts here, and in just a second we'll be talking to Wanda Korn from Stanford University about Gertrude Stein and pigeons and that opera. But before we do, Andrew Bleckman, do we know anything more about Picasso and pigeons? I mean, we know that he named his daughter Paloma, which means pigeon. Is there any other thing that we know of, like, why he would have done that?
Well, he loved them, is the short answer. He loved them enough to name his daughter after them. And if you know, the bird, the girl with a dove is one of his most beautiful pictures ever, one of the most beautiful paintings. And it's interesting. It's really only in the United States, from what I can tell, that where pigeons are so debated, except for maybe Trafalgar Square in London. Generally, all through human history, they've been worshipped as fertility goddesses. They've been seen as a gentle friend who will visit you every day, you know, at the same time if that's when you feed them. They're seen as, all through the Middle East and Baghdad, pigeon racing and the keeping of pigeons is a big sport. They're beloved. Ancient Rome was filled with pigeons. And so, I mean, it's just kind of unusual that that's not the case here.
Well, just as we're heading towards the home stretch here, we are going to talk about pigeons in the arts. And I wanted to set that up by saying in 1995, three researchers, Watanabe, Sakamoto, and Wakita, described an experiment in which they showed pigeons paintings by Picasso and Monet and trained them so that that they would obtain food when they pecked at a Picasso or pecked for a Picasso rather than a Monet, and that the pigeons then were able to distinguish between a Picasso and a Monet when it was a painting that they had never seen before, so that they eventually came to understand what Picasso's style was as opposed to Monet's, at least for their purposes. And in a later paper, one of the same researchers showed that if pigeons and human college students undergo the same training, their performance in telling a Van Gogh from a Chagall is pretty much the same. So pigeons and the arts, it's a natural pairing, apparently. But, you know, the place that they really surface the most, at least for me, one of the most memorable Gertrude Stein lines. In fact, if you know almost nothing else about Gertrude Stein except for a rose is a rose is a rose and there is no there there, maybe the third thing you know is Pigeons on the Grass, alas, especially if you know James Thurber's spirited contra Stein response to this. But joining us right now to explain, and part of the exciting thing about Pigeons on the Grass, alas, is that it's intimately tied into the history of Hartford, Connecticut, where Virgil Thompson and Gertrude Stein's opera Four Saints in Three Acts premiered under the directorship of John Hasman. So Wanda Korn, Robert and Ruth Halpern Professor Emerita, Department of Art and Art History at Stanford University, joins us. Maybe just to sort of set things up, Wanda Korn, we'll just play a little bit of the musical intonation of Pigeons on the Grass, Alas.
Pigeons on the grass, alas. Pigeons on the grass, alas. Short, long grass, short, longer, longer, shorter, yellow grass. Pigeons, large pigeons, on the shorter, longer, yellow grass, alas. Pigeons on the grass.
All right, that's from Four Saints in Three Acts. So Wanda Korn, welcome to the show. And to the extent that anybody can ever figure out what's going on with Gertrude Stein, what's going on with Gertrude Stein and Pigeons on the Grass?
Well, it's a great question, and I can't give you a definitive answer because that's always impossible with Stein.
Yeah, I would be so disappointed if you could.
But what we should say is that this opera that we just heard one little aria from, or piece of an aria, is called Four Saints in Three Acts, and it is about saints in Spain, 16th, 17th century, much older saints. And one of them, Saint Ignatius, who is singing that aria, it's been said by an interpreter, is actually having a vision as he sings about birds. And they're, of course, pigeons, which at the time would have been a very kind of ordinary bird for a saint to be thinking of. You'd think a saint would think of a white dove, which in Christianity has had a long history as a bird about purity, about God, about peace. But instead, he has his vision through pigeons. And that makes some sense, if that indeed was what was on Stein's mind, because she had a sense of humor. She, I think, always wanted to talk in very natural vernacular language. She always spoke in the first tense, that is when she wrote. And, of course, she liked repetitions. And somehow Pigeons on the Grass has just enough of a little alliteration and harmony to it, Pigeons on the Grass, alas, that I think she came to like that phrase so much. It worked much better than dove, which would just be a dud of a word compared with what she wants to do with it. So it's right in the middle of the opera, and Thompson, Virgil Thompson, who wrote the music for Stein's libretto, made it into a kind of, if you will, a kind of hit tune of this particular opera.
And to the extent that any hits emerge from Four Saints in Three Acts.
Yeah.
So James Thurber wrote a mock Contra Stein essay about this particular line, about this particular aria, in which he objected lengthily to the whole trope. At one point he said, you could dress up a pigeon in a tiny suit of evening clothes and put a tiny silk hat on his head and a tiny gold-headed cane under his wing and send him walking into my room at night. It would make no impression on me. I would not shout, good God Almighty, the birds are in charge. So he was objecting to the idea that pigeons can inspire any profound emotions in anybody. I don't think he was terribly serious about that. But Wanda, as we look at a poem like this, is it like James Joyce, too, that at a certain point she's just so much in love with a certain cadence of language and the flowing together of sounds that parsing it for actual sense is kind of beside the point?
Yes, I think that's very well said. It's the musicality of the language. It is making you hear language because you listen more intensely when it's not making sense to you. And so then you might be able to get into the musicality in which the language is both spoken and in this case, sung. Unlike Joyce, though, who very often had considerable ideas about references that his chosen words would call up. And so you can have a compendium of lines from Joyce that will tell you about the intellectual stimulus behind it or the symbolism behind it or where the phrase might have been used by somebody else and is being here appropriated by Joyce. You don't find that kind of allusions to other bigger intellectual traditions in Stein. So it's the sounds that are thrilling her. Plus, she really loved ordinary language, and I think Joyce loved extraordinary language, if I can put it that way. The two of them were not much in the way of friends. They both were in Paris, but I think probably for each of them, they did not see an alliance with the other. Mm-hmm. And if anything, they sort of kept themselves apart and had different audiences for their work and different friendship circles.
The parts of the aria sound like an discovered fourth verse of I Am the Walrus. If a magpie in the sky cannot cry, if the pigeon on the grass, alas, can alas, and to pass the pigeon on the grass, alas, and the magpie in the sky. It goes on and on like this. Thank you so much, Wanda Corn. Thanks to Andrew Bleckman, also author of Pigeons. If your taste was whetted by this, by Pigeons, the fascinating saga of the world's most revered and reviled bird. Also thanks to Yoni Appelbaum, and thank you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow unless for some reason we don't show up.
All right.